Good evening, and ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage OCCC's President, Paul Sechrest.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Oklahoma City Community College. You're in our newest facility, the Visual and Performing Arts Center Theater. We have made a strong commitment to the arts here in South Oklahoma City. For many, many years, all of our choirs have been doing their performances off campus. We've had award ceremonies off campus. We needed a place on campus where our students could really enjoy all of the performances and have their celebrations right here. So we built this incredible theater. It's also open to the public. We'll host a number of events throughout the year that we hope that you'll take advantage of. I think there's some propaganda, some flyers out in the foyer if you haven't seen it. But we're so glad you're here on our campus this evening. It is an honor for Oklahoma City Community College to host one of the last town halls that Senator Coburn will be having. You know, he was first elected to the Senate in 2004. He's served with distinction for the last 10 years, and he's going to step down later this year, as you know. He has been a tireless supporter and champion of efficiency and effectiveness in government. If you've watched the videos, you know the committees he's served on, you know the leadership, you know what he has stood for. There is probably not a person in this audience who doesn't know that he has stood for Oklahoma values for the last decade. Please help me welcome to Oklahoma City Community College, Dr. Tom Coburn.
Thank you, Dr. Sechrest. Thank you. Appreciate it. Sit down. Good evening. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for giving me the privilege to be able to represent this great state. The greatest part of my week is Thursday night or Friday morning when I get to come back home. And I do that every week. And it's the draw within me of Oklahoma and what you all stand for and what our state stands for and the hard work and the sacrifice and the people of our state, all mixes, all types, all kinds. So it, for the last 10 years, it's flown by. It's been an honor and a privilege, and those are understatements when I say that, to be able to represent our great state. My decision to leave really didn't have anything to do with my health. I know that's not what was necessarily reported. All through my life, whether it was in business, as I left business and I went to medicine, when I left medicine and went into politics, I followed that still, small voice that has guided me in my faith in everything that I've done. And it's become very clear that that what I think about that and what it's going to be, is I think I can have a greater influence outside of the Senate than I can in. And leaving is, a position such as this is not fulfilling the full 6 years, but it's the right thing for me to do as I follow what I'm called to do. My health, by the way, is fine. I've got great doctors. I'm fighting a long-term battle. We all lose in the long run. You're all going to lose, and so will I. I'm 66 years old, and every day is a pleasure for me. And having a health consequence is good for us because it redirects us to what's really important. And so it helped me listen better. So I'm excited about what the future holds for me and my grandkids and me getting to spend more time with them, but also the other things that I can do outside of the Senate that I can't do while I'm in the Senate. And so it's a time of change for Carolyn and I and our life. She's already told me I can't be home more than 4 months a year. She can't tolerate that. So I'll have to find something that keeps me out of the house for a good portion of it. She's, the last 20 years, she's been responsible for running our home. And she, quite frankly, has done a better job than I could have. So appreciate her support, my family support. As I look at our country today, what is really missing is confidence and trust And the idea that we can really accomplish what we set our mind to. And the reason that's there is because we've had failed leadership, Republican and Democrat alike. And leadership is what matters. And we need to restore that. And we're the ones that get to restore that. As private citizens, I'm going to be right there with you trying to restore that. And that means being very selective on who we send to represent us, not voting a party label, but really checking out individuals. Because, you know, there are some great people that don't have the same label that I have. Well, I think of Angus King from Maine. He's not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. He's a true independent. And boy, does he have common sense. He doesn't look at anything from a partisan angle. He looks at it for where's the problem and how do we solve it. And so what we need to do is get more of that with my label on it. I like that Republican label, but that doesn't mean it's always right. But we need to get more of that to where we're really addressing the real problems and not addressing the symptoms of it. And my hope is and my prayer, quite frankly, I teach a Sunday school class. The average age is 82. And you think there isn't some wisdom in that room from those 82 years. But we pray every Sunday and every day of the week. I actually carry my prayer list in my pocket. So I'm reminded every time I reach in my pocket what I really should be, what's most important. But we're praying for the country. And I think we all need to do that. We didn't get to where we are as a nation, the greatest nation on the history of the earth ever known to man, outside of a connection to the originator of it all. And intellectual minds can argue that, but it's foolishness in the sight of the Creator. So I think, you know, my answer to most things is go to the author and find out what he says, and you can solve a lot of problems. And we're not doing enough of that as a nation. And then we get the direction that we need to go. So with that, I'll stop talking. And the whole purpose of a town hall meeting is for me to hear from you, not me to talk all the time. And I have microphones, but what we're going to do, we have a rule on the microphones, is we hold the microphones. Because, you know, it's hard to get them back once you give them away. So whoever wants to speak, well, hopefully we'll have enough time. We're going to be here till 7:30, I think. Isn't that right, Craig? 7:30. So hopefully we can get everybody's question answered. And it's not a debate. I'll try to answer them as honestly as I can. And some of the answers you might like and some you won't. But the one thing I'm going to do is tell you what I think. And I may be wrong in it, but I'll still put it out there. So who goes first? Got somebody right here in the middle.
Thank you for your service, Senator. Senator, I have been concerned over the last several years of reading reports of various government agencies buying up tons and tons of ammunition. I can understand some of our law enforcement agencies needing ammunition, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture? Do you know anything about this vast buying of ammunition by these government agencies that are supposedly very quiet non-law enforcement agencies?
Yeah. Well, when this first came up, it was really directed to Homeland Security. And so I inquired of it and actually became satisfied on what they were buying based on certification rounds. We have a report that you're going to see in October, maybe November. One of the things our founders warned us against is having a national police force. And we think right now there's close to 100,000 people employed by the federal government that are police. And that ought not be so. One, because your community has police force, and they're ultimately responsible. And guess who we trust? We trust our police forces. The second thing, I'll give you a little story, and we're confirming this now, but 24 crack troops showed up in North Carolina this week. Six SUVs, fully loaded, to confiscate a car for the EPA that the EPA has said was a pollutant. Now, first of all, I've inquired. I've already sent a letter to the head of Homeland Security, and I'm in the midst of doing this investigation on all of it. But if you want to get a real fight started, show up at my yard with 24 people. Property rights matter, personal rights matter, and we have local police forces to enforce the law. They don't just enforce our state law or our city law. They enforce all the law. They're sworn to enforce the law. So we need to push back on this because of the dangers associated with it. So you'll see coming from my office before I leave a complete report on what's happened and why we need to downsize that. Who's next?
Senator, I want to say I appreciate your conservative efforts on pointing out the places where funds are being spent foolishly and unnecessarily, the various things that were on the screen that preceded this meeting. I agree with you on that, and I also am concerned about that. In many places, I do not share the optimism that you stated at the beginning. I am very fearful that not only is Congress broken, but our nation is so badly divided that it's going to be very difficult to come together and compromise on things. My concern is, and I have been to many of your grassroots meetings, I do not agree with you on most of your political decisions.
Most of them are fiscal, so you mean other than fiscal?
Yes. Okay. But also there are some of your approaches to the fiscal side are a little bit too one-sided. It seems to me like you're protecting those who have great funds at the cost of those of us who have a lesser amount of funds. But that's not my question. My question to you, you've been in the Senate now for a number of years. You're leaving. You've done your best. I would like to know what you consider are two things non-physical that you were able to accomplish during your service in the Senate, and what are two things that you would like to see accomplished when you leave?
Well, I think the number one thing and the number two thing are both the same thing, is building reconciliation between members. You're a product of the manipulation of the media in this country. What is broken in the U.S. Senate is the majority leader, where only 20 amendments in the last year have been offered by members of the Senate on bills. Our founders created the Senate for two reasons. One is so that minority rights and minority point of view can always be protected, whether it's Republican, Whig, Democrat, progressive, it doesn't matter. The whole point was to do that. And number two is so that things would slow down, so that long-term thought and wisdom and judgment could be applied to the decisions of the House. That hadn't happened for 4.5 years in the Senate. And it hadn't happened because we don't get along. It hadn't happened because the majority leader doesn't want to put things on the floor and have amendments that might be a voice of somebody different than his philosophy. So what you've seen is the rules of the Senate be changed by breaking the rules of the Senate. And what you've seen as supposedly, when we want to pass a bill, we can. If he doesn't block it. But he blocks 95% of what's there. Just remember, when the Senate functions, everybody can offer any amendment they want to any bill. And it's a self-restraining process. That hadn't occurred in the last 4 years in the U.S. Senate. So I get along great with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I work with them. Tom Carper and I have passed more pieces of legislation out of Homeland Security in the last 2 years than been passed in 6 or 8 years before, because we work cordially and collegially across the aisle to build compromise to solve problems. But those bills never see the light of day because they might have amendments or they might not meet the czar of the Senate's decision on whether or not we ought to take it up, even though it might be the best thing for the country to do it. So I believe you've been influenced inappropriately to what actually is happening in the Senate.
Just the
That's right. That was. Remember the. Do you know the history of the Senate? When the Senate was first created, one senator could stop anything. It took 100% agreement to do anything.
But he had to speak.
Whether you speak or not, the only reason we don't have to speak is because they don't want to be there to make us speak. That's laziness on their part. I'm happy to speak all the time. So then it was changed to 75, then it was changed to 67, and then it was changed to 60. That's the founders' vision of protecting minority rights. That's no, but if you'll read the Federalist Papers, you will be enlightened as to why those rules are there. Now, if in fact you're right and I'm wrong, and you want a 51 vote on everything in the Senate, then eliminate the Senate and just have a unicameral legislature. You won't have the thing. Our founders wanted things to move very slowly. That's why they created the bicameral legislature. That's why they put roadblocks. That's why they wanted the Senate to force consensus. There's no forcing of consensus because there's no opportunity to put your ideas out. Well, let's not have a debate. The difference is this. I've been there for 10 years. I'm not known as an insider in the Senate. I'm known as an outsider, but I'm also known as a compromiser. So if you take any liberal senator and ask, will he work with you, the answer will be yes. The fact is your viewpoint of that and mine are 180 degrees, and I've actually been there and seen what's happened. And I saw what happened in 2005 and 2006 when the Senate did function, and the majority leader didn't decide they would control everything and didn't change the rules in the Senate. And guess what? It worked. We passed legislation. We passed the appropriation bills. We passed the budget just like the law says we did. We haven't passed one budget. We haven't passed any appropriation bills because they don't want to take any votes. Because the next election is the most important to them, thing to them, not the country. Okay, next question. Well, what I'm going to do is give everybody a chance. My first thing is reconciliation. The two things I'd like to see happen is majority leader change in the Senate, whether we take control or not. All right, where are we?
I'd like to pursue a little bit on the federal police force and give a little personal example right here in Oklahoma City. I attended the June food truck festival down. They have on the end each Friday, the last Friday of the month, and I was down in the June's event. And as I was down there, two gentlemen in black uniforms, titled Department of Homeland Security, walked by, fully armed, patrolling this event. My question to you is, under whose authority and what authority do they have to walk around there, and what are they looking for and what can they do?
Yeah, I don't know, and that's the question I'm asking as I try to develop this report. But I'd love the details on that. Craig Smith is here. Would you give him the details so we can put it and then we can ask the questions?
Hi, Senator.
Hi there.
I had a question about our wages. I'm not sure who's in charge of it. As I understand, there are a lot of businesses in charge of raising the wage and getting the order to make a higher wage per hour. And I wanted to see if there's anything that we can do to introduce that bill and get it moving forward, because it seems like it's been put to a stop.
Okay. I think you're talking about the minimum wage legislation. Nobody can make it today on the minimum wage. Nobody can. The most brilliant person in the world couldn't make it on the minimum wage. 75% of the people that are in minimum wage jobs, it's a first job for them. 25% it's not. They're kind of locked in. When I look at the economic studies, reading both the progressive viewpoint and the conservative viewpoint, my conclusion comes is in the long run, if we do hikes in the minimum wage, ultimately the very people we say we're wanting to help will not have a true benefit from it. They may have more cash in their pocket, but when the wages work through on those type jobs, what happens is the costs go up for the very necessities that you might need. The real way to raise wages is to raise skills, to empower you. I don't know if you all remember, but I was very critical of the job training programs that the federal government run. Matter of fact, we had 47 of them. We spend $19 billion a year. All but three of them overlap, and only two of them have real metrics on them. Well, out of that, and we did a study, we looked at all job training programs in Oklahoma, both the federal ones and the state ones. And what we found in that was that the state programs actually help people get a skill, to get a job, to advance themselves. What we found in the federal programs is what we were doing was very good. We were employing people and training, but we weren't training people for a life skill. So it's a combination. The best way for your wages to go up is for us to empower you with additional skills. And that bill was defeated in the Senate, was defeated in the House, and it probably won't happen, even though now it's harder because the very thing, food, rent, gasoline, are rising faster than any wage increase you might get, even if you are working at that minimum. So I think as a physician, I always try to go to the heart of the problem rather than the symptoms of the problem. The heart of the problem is we haven't given you a skill set, haven't helped you get a skill set to where you can actually empower yourself to demand a higher wage.
Nathaniel Batchelder, Senator of the Peace House in Oklahoma City. Let me say that your commitment to fiscal responsibility has actually helped some organizations I work with. So that's number one. Number two, your courage is impressive to us all, and I pray to God that in 25 years you and I both are going to be standing here doing political work. So that's number
I hope
two.
I'm on the other side.
Well, we may come closer.
I don't want to be 91.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Don't you hurt now?
Well, 38 days ago, I had a knee replacement, so yes, I hurt a little bit.
Are you doing your PT?
Absolutely.
Good for you.
Yeah, I'm walking.
And what's your flexion right now?
Five to 115.
115?
Yeah.
Good.
I'm going to get down to zero and 120.
Good.
Dr. David Holden at McBride.
Zero, that means he was going to get down to where he can go like this with his legs straight out and go way past 90 degrees. 30 degrees past. That's great.
Yeah, I'm going to be...
Hurts, doesn't it?
It's worth it. I'm on the road to recovery, so...
All right.
Pray we both are. Not at all. The heart of the world is broken by the rockets and the killing and the misunderstandings in Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, both parts. And as an activist for justice and peace... I think all of us, we just don't know quite what to do. Call for ceasefires, do the best we can. We can't make either Israel or the Palestinians do this, that, the other thing. I just want to say that in between military action, an observation of the life of the Palestinians is that they are enduring what I would say are some pretty serious human rights challenges, which others have called attention to. National and international organizations. And I think that it puts a lot of pressure on them. And while rockets are the worst way to respond to try to make a point, then the rockets are going in both directions. And the killing, of course, is, 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 in favor. I mean, Israel could, of course, obliterate the Palestinian regions militarily. Immediately. So anything the Israelis do shows restraint, although in a way it doesn't look like it. I just want to ask, what more can the United States do with its influence, with its money? I know we give a lot of support, military and financial, to Israel. However, to bring this tragedy to a close. And I'll listen carefully to your reply. And I also appreciate what you've said about civil dialogue. May we all do that.
This is what's called a conundrum. I can put myself in the shoes of Israel and see having several hundred rockets over several months fired with no response and issuing warnings that if you continue to do it, we're going to be forced to act. I can put myself in the position of the Hamas, which is a terrorist organization who's actually using the Palestinians as a foil. And then I can put myself in the position of a Palestinian that's not associated with Hamas, saying, what do I do? How do I get out of this? You know, there's been instances where they forced people to rooftops on buildings they knew had paper leaflets, warning shots, everything else to say, we're getting ready to bomb this. You've got 15 minutes to get out of here. And forcing people back up through the building, put them on the rooftops to use them as a shield. Everybody's losing, including us, in this. And the only thing I know is you got to love people, even people who disagree with you. But leadership matters, and I think that's part of the question. What can we do to lead on that? We can't say we have a policy and then not live with it. So we need very clear and distinct policies. We have the power to actually do a lot of things in the world, but we're so war-weary that we've now entrenched as a country, and the world is much worse off because of it. And it's not just in the Middle East. It's in Crimea and Ukraine. It's in Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and Tunisia. It's all those areas where we had hopes for the Arab Spring, and yet we didn't leave. I think Israel made a mistake in responding so quickly to what was happening. I think they did exactly what Hamas wanted them to do, because Hamas had gone down to about 15% of support in Gaza. And I don't know where we are today. I haven't kept up with the news today. I don't know where we are. But I think, restraint, strong diplomatic quietness in terms of how we're urging. I actually believe in the state of Israel. I believe they have the right to exist. Hamas does not. Their statement is they need to be eliminated. They do not believe they need to be destroyed. They do not have the right to exist as a nation. We're not going to solve this here, but it's heart-wrenching what's happening. It's heart-wrenching for even the military officer that says strike and people are killed. I mean, war is terrible. And it's not any better in this instance. No matter which side you're on, it's terrible. And I don't blame our administration because of what's going on in Gaza and between the Palestinians and Israel. That's been going on for a long time as I read my Bible. The question is there's a way you do that, and that's loving people. And you know, loving people. My dad loved me a lot, but he whooped me a lot too. And I think a little bit of that needs to go along with it. So I don't have an answer for you other than I'm so sorry it's happening.
Thank you, Senator Coburn.
Where are we? Okay, got you. Found you.
Lloyd Smith from Edmond. Thank you for serving with distinction and godly character and conviction. We appreciate what you've done for both our state and our country. I have a question regarding the budget and fiscal type situations that I know is very important to you, and I want to commend you for identifying so many examples of fraud, waste, and abuse in the federal government. And what I would like to see is a process that, when documented fraud, waste, and abuse is identified, that the agency or the department that's responsible would have their budget cut by a corresponding amount, which would then encourage them to police their own internal budget process and spending a lot better. And then secondly, along the same line, that we would put a provision in the budget that when we give foreign aid, that it's provision based on the fact that the country continues to do what's in the best interest of the United States, and that if it's not, it's immediately withdrawn or cut. And I'm just wondering why we can't do these things more effectively, because it just seems like common sense. You know, if they're wasting money, let's cut their budget by a corresponding amount. And if a country's out there like the Muslim Brotherhood, we don't need to be giving them any money. We need to have a process to immediately withdraw it. So I would be interested in how we could do that.
I think the one key thing you said in your statement is what there's a total absence of in Washington, which is common sense. No, I don't say that lightly. I mean, let me just give you an example. Last week, Senator Toomey put on the transportation bill, up for a vote, an amendment that says, if a bridge is damaged and has to be repaired, and you know you're going to repair it, right? If we got a highway coming up, we got a highway going away from a bridge, and it's damaged and we need to rebuild it, you know you're going to do it. That you shouldn't have to go through a NEPA process again, the environmental impact statement, all the associated costs with that, right? That makes sense, right? You know you're going to build the bridge. The bridge was there already. Whatever environmental impact it has, you're not going to have any more. It got voted down in the U.S. Senate. So it tells you where we are. I agree with you 100%. I'll give you another little example. Remember sequester? And all the warnings from the president that we're going to have to lay off all these people and we're going to terminate all these people. You know how many people were actually fired during this sequester? One. One person.
Who is that?
They were in one obscure branch, and I can give you the exact number. I put it out.
Give me the name, then.
I can't give you the name. I can give you the... But the fact is that's a fact. You know, adversity creates opportunity. Except we never have any adversity inside the federal government because nobody ever pulls their milk chain away. And it creates creativity. I'll tell you some great things. There are some positive things happening. You know Tinker out here? The general that runs that? During sequester, she cut an additional $4 billion through good management techniques of all three of the depots throughout the country. Wow. How'd she do that? She took business principles called continuing process improvement and lean manufacturing, which she'd studied and convinced her other generals, and they made big changes, big savings for us. So it's not that it can't be done. It's that here's her initiative doing it. She's a four-star general. Her name's Wolfenberger. She's great. Now, what we need to do is copy that. Yeah. And she's a proud, loyal, patriotic American that knows we're in trouble, and she's going to do her part.
Is she the one that got fired?
No. No. I can have my staff look up. Somebody go to our website while we're here and look up that agency that lost the one employee.
Look up the obscure person that you can't name? Can you have your people look at it?
Who's our next question?
I am, right here. I'm an American veteran. Are you afraid to talk to me?
I'm not afraid to talk to anybody, and if you behave, you might actually get to ask a question. All right, let's hear a question. No, right here. She was.
Hi. I'd just like you to know that you're my idol as far as your exposing waste in government, and it makes me proud as an Oklahoman to see you nationally recognized for that. But my issue is the problems with Child Protective Services. That why does the federal government pay 90% of their money based on children being removed from their homes, and only like 10% that goes to try to keep the families together? That has led to a lot of problems and corruption with Child Protective Services, and like that Justina case in Massachusetts is a perfect example. And we can say in Oklahoma, well, that's Massachusetts, but I can state for fact that that happens everywhere, and it happens in Oklahoma. Since the Pinnacle Plan, there's now 11,000 kids in foster care where there was 8,000 before, and nobody is asking why has it grown, and why are a third of the foster care kids in Oklahoma County? We've had a really bad experience with them. There's no due process. And when you get in, you're literally in a kangaroo court. And this agency needs oversight. It needs accountability. And again, I'd like to ask why 90% of the money under that Title IV-E is spent when the kids are removed from their home. And then there's adoption bonuses, and states have quotas that they have to meet to send their kids away from their families and get adopted by other people. Okay. Why is it done that way?
Well, I think a lot of things are done that way. Going back to the basic question.
I am not saying that there aren't times.
No. Let me finish. If you read the Constitution and the enumerated powers, and you look at the Bill of Rights, can you find the authority anywhere there for the federal government to be involved in interstate adoptions, interstate family welfare, anything? So what has happened to us is a combination of things. But the first thing is abandoning the very wisdom of our founders on what they said and how we should run our country. That's why Mason put Article 5 in the Constitution, because he knew the natural tendency for republics is to degenerate away from their freedom and away from their liberty. So the real problem is the federal government's involved in it at all. You have a state senator here who probably had never heard that. But the point is what we need. Things work best under local control.
Amen.
Where things are accountable. And when we expand it, where we let the federal government tell us what, how, when, why we do everything, you lose liberty. And we got veterans in the office. I mean, in this, they put their butt on the line to protect that liberty. So what liberty are they protecting when we're losing it? Through an expansive, unlimited federal government.
Senator, it seems like now child neglect is defined by, you do something that I don't agree with. And I know this case that happened like last week, and I'm not saying that I agree with it, but this mother got arrested for letting her kid walk to the park unaccompanied. I mean, when I was growing up, my mom had been in jail every day.
There's no judgment with that, and there's no judgment in Washington, because Washington, remember Coburn's rule of bureaucracy. Never do what is best when you can do what is safe for the bureaucracy. That means always write rules and regulations so you can't be criticized if something goes wrong. So that's where we find ourselves today. That's why I believe we need a constitutional convention to limit the power of the federal government, and to reestablish term limits, to reestablish a balanced budget amendment, and reestablish some control over regulations that are coming out of the government, whether it's Republican president or Democrat. Both of them do. And we're losing our freedom because of what we're seeing happen with this humongous, large, unresponsive, poor judgment, lack of common sense, federal government. All right.
I'm still standing.
Yeah, I understand. And when you start behaving, I might recognize you.
This attendee asked that. This attendee has hearing problems and therefore speech problems, so she asked that I read this question that she's typed out for us. Philippians 2:4 says, each of you should look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. How are you implementing this with regards to legalizing marijuana for medical use?
I don't believe marijuana should be legalized for anything. All medical studies on it, all of them, you can't find one positive. Every study done in the medical literature shows a negative correlation for people's lives and their health and their spirit in utilization of marijuana. There are two drugs available right now through the FDA for those people who say they need it for nausea or they need it for pain control. You can get both those drugs through a prescription. I think the people in Oklahoma that really want marijuana to be legalized, Colorado's open. Go there. The problems they're going to see. There was just an article in the paper 2 weeks ago. Colorado's surprised that homelessness has increased in Denver after they passed the marijuana. What do you expect? Smoking one joint is like smoking 17 cigarettes. The carcinogens in weed, and this is much more powerful weed than when I was first exposed to it, and I didn't try it, and I didn't inhale it. What the fact is what you're seeing today is far more potent. And the neuroscience associated with marijuana is that it markedly takes away initiative, markedly takes away judgment, and is a character drug for other drug addiction. So why would we do that? You know, you can say, well, we got alcohol. Well, that's bad enough. Why add another? And I understand my libertarian friends think you ought to be able to do anything, anytime, in any way. But in civil society, there has to be some limits, and that's one I think we ought to have. All right, he's behaving. It's your turn. No, you get one question, so figure out which one you want to ask.
What has President Obama done? I don't need it. I can speak loud enough without that.
Sir?
Can everyone hear me?
No!
We don't want to.
I'm doing the process. What is it that President Obama has done that warrants him being impeached? That's the first question I have. Are you able to answer a second question after we've done this question?
I've never said he should be impeached.
Okay. Your friends in the Republican Party have said that.
A few, but not many.
Okay. Now, how do you feel about suing President Obama?
I think it's absolutely appropriate.
Now, How many times has the United States House of Representatives actually, as a body, sued the President of the United
States?
Never
before.
I'm not talking about just individuals here and there.
It's never happened.
So this is pretty much unprecedented.
Yeah, so are the actions of the President in terms of his executive order.
Yeah, I know. Now, what was it?
I'd just remind you. The president's 0-2 going to court on his executive orders. He's 0-2. So the court so far, the reason the House is initiating this, and I'm not in the House, the Senate hadn't initiated it, is the reason the House has initiated it because I, as a member of Congress, don't have standing to sue the president. And that's probably good because we'd fill the courts with members of Congress when they have a tenter tantrum and they don't get their way.
Right.
But there's something totally different about the House of Representatives suing the president. And we'll see. The courts will decide that question. You won't decide it. I won't decide it. But the courts will decide.
No, we won't. Now, has...
All right, you're on your third question and this final one.
Oh, yeah, because I guess I don't have any more intelligent questions. Is that
no, right? That's not what I said. But if you want all these other people to have a chance, we might give them. And you've already taken about 5 minutes with your annex.
I have more intelligent questions than some of the...
All right, hold the mic. That's it.
Next question right here.
Senator, I heard that there is a Senate bill, and the only senator I can think of that signed on to it is Senator McCain. And I don't know if it's true or not, but it would, if it was a law, it would make what the citizens in Murrieta, California did, turning back the illegals from Central America, that would make that a felony.
That's not true. That's not something that I'm aware of. And whether he introduced a bill, I don't think that's the case. Senator McCain, I heard him speak at our policy lunch this week, believes we ought to modify the 2008 law on trafficking, which created this part of this mess. The other thing was an executive order that sent a signal. Just so you all will know, the El Paso Intelligence Center interviewed with the Border Patrol the first 250 people, children, who came here, quote, teenagers, that's who they are, about why they were coming. Not one of them was coming because of poverty. Not one of them was coming because they feared for their life. They all came because they'd heard that if you get across the border, you can stay. That's the intelligence on it. So you can read a whole lot of stuff in the press, but if you read the El Paso, which the Border Patrol was, I give Jay Johnson credit. He's a great manager of Homeland Security. He just, it's so big, he doesn't know everything's going on. But he's going to get that agency in shape. What we need to do is fix the real problems. And the problem is we're sending a signal, come here, you won't have to go home. Well, we need to change that signal. And sending thousands home already of women with their children is sending that signal, and that's one of the reasons things are slowing down. All right.
Senator Coburn, my name is Wes Bledsoe. I'm a citizen advocate with a perfect cause. And if there's any one person on Capitol Hill that I personally have faith in to be able to help us, it's you. Right now we have systemic failures in our state's nursing home industry, as a matter of fact, America's nursing home industry, and our government oversight agencies. In Oklahoma, we have 3,500 people who are dying basically of human rights violations every year. Across America, the number's closer to 500,000. Part of that's based on the CDC's estimate that 380,000 people are dying in nursing homes across America every year just due to infections alone. Earlier this year, the Department of Health and Human Services issued a report that one-third of people going into nursing homes for skilled care are having adverse outcomes. In fact, this past Friday, I attended the funeral of an American veteran, a Vietnam veteran, who died because of the skilled care he should have received but failed to receive adequate skilled care in a nursing home here in Oklahoma City. On May 13th, we sent a letter to President Obama that we copied you and many other congressional leaders, senators, and other federal officials pleading for investigations as well as Senate hearings and House hearings in this matter. We have nursing home operators that are diverting millions, in fact, billions of dollars from the care of nursing home residents and patients. In fact, we have one nursing home chain here in Oklahoma that's diverted easily over $100 million in the last 14 years through its real estate scheme of common ownership, where they own the license operating
nursing home. I want you to get to a question so we can...
So my question is, what can you do to help us launch federal investigations as well as hearings into these matters to protect our veterans, their spouses, and others who are supposed to be receiving care as patients and residents in nursing homes?
I don't know. I haven't seen your letter yet. I'm sure it's there. It hadn't gotten to me yet. I am still 4,000 letters behind because I actually go over the letters, so you don't get a form letter from me. Let's go back to the physician deal. What's the real problem? What the real problem is we're transferring people to nursing home care when we should be caring for them ourselves and our families.
Yes.
I mean, that's if you really get down to the moral case. The second thing is we created a system to pay for it that has been utilized both by the state and the federal government that's hard to control. The question is every nursing home patient needs an advocate, and many of them don't have it. And so you have a system of nursing homes, which is going to grow, by the way, with the baby boom generation. I told my kids I'd just soon drive off the big daddy at 10 killer than you put me in a nursing home. I don't know if you all have ever been to Big Daddy, but it's a good fall. So I think the question is, you have regulation now. You have federal regulation. You have state regulation. Why isn't it working?
They're not being enforced.
Well, but why isn't it being enforced?
That's my question. That's my question to you. We need help with that.
The whole point is everybody's passing the buck.
Exactly.
So really what you want is stringent, tough nursing home regulations at the state level. Now, why is the federal government involved in it? Because you're getting federal money. Every time you take federal money, you get all these rules and regs. Now, I'm the last person to defend the nursing home industry. But if you look at what is now required, you're spending money that you would be caring for patients. I've never met a poor nursing home owner, so I'm with you. I get you. I'm there. But you know, we're giving it up. We're letting them regulate. And the states, well, the federal rules, who's accountable? That's what you're really asking.
Exactly.
Who's accountable? And the answer is right now, nobody. And I'll try to get you an answer to your question and see what we can do.
Appreciate working with you. Thank you, sir.
Right. Senator Colburn, thank you for your service. On a brief aside, as you well know, on an earlier question, the founders set up the Senate to be elected by and representative of state legislatures, which
right.
It still should be. Early 20th century progressives, in their great wisdom, said that's not a good idea. And they gave us the Federal Reserve and the federal income tax also. So judge that as it may be. My question is on a broad economic scale concerning federal entitlements, mainly Social Security and Medicare. I was born in 1958. That was the peak of the baby boom. There are more of me in my year than anybody else in this country, unfortunately. The federal government cannot print enough money to pay me what they've promised me every year in my little letter that I get. I would propose that, I'd say starting with the year I was born, 1958, January 1, send me a letter saying what we promised you earlier, that's going to be 40% less because this money does not and will not ever exist. And if it does exist, it would be borrowed from 14 generations down the line. That would be something small that my generation, as a baby boomer, could contribute to this country. Now, the Medicare, that's with the ACA and all of the uncertainty that's created. I won't even get into that. But I can say, you can tell me right now what I've been promised in Social Security. You can cut that 40%, and I can start making provisions as to what my retirement will be and take more ownership, which we need to do anyway as a nation, not depending on the federal government. That it was only supposed to be a small safety net, and it angers me when I see people think of Social Security as an entitlement when it is not. It is a Ponzi scheme, which Mitt Romney got executed for narrowly. I'm just saying, what would be the chances of legislation like that passing that would say, and I'd say you can start on my birthday with me.
Look. What you haven't had is bold leadership to say America's in trouble. Fiscally, we're in trouble. We cannot grow our way out of this. So we have to do reform. And the reform principles ought to be this. Everybody shares. And the more you make, the more you share. Real leadership says, let's solve our problems. Let's not ignore them. And so there could be an earnings test on Social Security. You know, you may be just fine now, but you may have a tragedy. And if you had a certain earnings and a certain asset amount. But there's all sorts of ways to fix it. The problem with not fixing it now is the very people who are going to be most dependent on it are going to get hurt the worst.
Yep.
There's no compassion to the progressive point that, oh, we can do. They'll pay you the money, but the money won't buy anything because they will have so inflated our currency that it has no value. So they'll pay you the money. They'll continue this charade. But the fact is there's not one problem in front of us as a nation we can't solve. We don't have the leadership that says, let's go solve it. It doesn't have to be my way, but not working on the problem is not acceptable to our kids and our grandkids. And you know, it's kind of like the old codger who had made a lot of money, and he burned it all up right before he died. Is I'm going to take it with me. You're not going to get it. And so, real freedom, real progress, real sustainment and accomplishment comes from sacrifice. Ask our veterans. Ask the people who never came back. It costs something. And we have big problems on Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, Social Security disability, federal retirees, the unfunded liability associated with that. We ought to have a combination of we're going to fix these and everybody's going to be unhappy how we did it, but we're all going to share. Because the longer we ignore it, the harder the problem is to solve, and the worse it's going to hurt. It's not going to hurt somebody that did really well. They'll make it. But the person who didn't do well, it's going to hurt tremendously. And so to me, I think it's cowardice that Congress won't address the real issues that are in front of this country. And the other thing is, you talk about restoring confidence. If you had a Congress that really fixed those things, they may not get reelected, but the country would have confidence that we don't have this big hole in our budget. And the future is not negative, it's now positive because we did the things that we needed to do to get our fiscal house in order. So, you know, I'm with you. I thank you for that. We should do it, but we don't have the leadership to do it. And I've tried. I was on the president's debt commission. I was in the Gang of Six, and we worked a couple of deals. I've tried to work with the president privately on working some deals. They don't want to get it done.
Did you say the president's debt commission? Senator,
where are we?
Up here.
Okay.
I had an email from Rick Daniels of Infowars.com. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but he quoted two border agents down in Texas of saying that the UN has said that we must classify illegal aliens as refugees, and that they are also telling us where they are to be sent. And this is from the UNHRC Commission. And he also...
Did he send you the document that backs that up?
No, I do not have that. I was just hoping that you might know.
The first thing I would ask for is, let's see the proof.
Yeah, and that's why I was hoping you could inquire about it in your office.
I can. If you'll send that to Craig Smith, we'll try to get you an answer on that. I'm not a big fan of the UN. We send them $7 billion and don't have any idea where our money's going.
And those two agents said that all the liberals keep talking about all these young kids coming over. He said they are not all young kids. They have intercepted many of them in the 15 to 18 bracket with tattoos with MS-13 on them, indicating they are part of a gang.
Yeah, yeah. The average age, I think, of the kids is like 15.2 years old.
Yeah, yeah. So I just wondered if you could find out about that.
I'll be happy to check it out.
Yeah.
It would not surprise me, but just remember, if we haven't signed an international treaty on how we handle refugees, the UN has no business poking their nose into what we're doing.
Over here on your right, sir.
Dr. Coburn, first I want to thank you for your reputation as Dr. No. And I want to thank you for signing on to the letter against Common Core early on. Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Well, let me give you a caveat on that. What I said is the federal government doesn't have any business telling us what we'll do on that, and Oklahomans ought to decide.
That's right.
And Oklahomans should decide that.
And also, thank you for spending your time with us tonight. I appreciate that. My question is, what are you going to do next?
Well, I'm going to do a lot of things. I'm going to work on a constitutional convention, going around the country to talk to state legislators. I'm going to try to set up a nonprofit that will actually continue a lot of the oversight work that we're doing. So that I'm convinced American people need to see the transparency. We issued a press release today on USspending.gov. 90% of it's inaccurate. That was President Obama's signature accomplishment in the U.S. Senate. It was supposed to be 100% online and accurate by 2013. The latest GAO report says it's not accurate. So garbage in, garbage out. Yep. So, you know, here's one thing that should be working great that isn't, and it's because they're not paying attention to it. So we need to reemphasize that. And then I'm going to follow that still voice of what I'm supposed to do. Obedience is key to my part of the faith, and I plan on, you know, I'm sure I'll do some medical missionary work like I did before I was in the Senate. You know, I was in Kurdistan for a pretty long period of time, and I've been to Haiti, and I look forward to trying to use some of the skills that Oklahomans helped pay to get me trained in and share that with people who are less fortunate than we are.
Senator, I'm sorry I don't have a 10-minute dissertation before my question, but my question is, does it look like the Congress is going to take our 401ks and our IRAs and confiscate those?
I don't think so.
With the deficit that we have, I have read that there's a lot of money there.
Well, there's a lot of money there, but there's a lot of people. You know, my take is none of them have the courage to do that because they know they'd all lose, and their most important thing is to get reelected.
I sure hope you're right.
All right, let me give the answer. The person who lost their job worked for the U.S. Parole Commission, the only person who lost a job during the sequester.
Right over here, sir.
Oh, yes, Senator Coburn. You said you're going to set up a nonprofit. Is that what you said?
Yeah,
nonprofit?
I'm going to try to.
How are you going to get that through the IRS?
I'm not sure. Good question. I'm sure I'll get extra scrutiny.
To your left, Dr. Coburn. Okay.
Where are you?
No.
Okay. Where? Okay.
Is there a reason why we need to continue providing pensions for elected government officials?
For elected? Maybe. There are a lot of members of the Senate that haven't been as fortunate as I have.
I know.
And if you want people to go, other than the elite, maybe you want to have it. Remember, the pensions were all changed in 1995 when I was in Congress. I'll be eligible for a pension, whether I take it or not. And my pension is about $28,000 a year.
Well, the only reason I say that is because...
And my life expectancy isn't all that great, so it's a good deal for you all.
Yeah, and I understand that, particularly from your rural states, and you have representatives and senators that come from maybe low economic areas. Yeah. But when you look at television and radio, cable TV, and so many people that were elected and they leave, and then they become stars. And, you know, they're on boards of directors making $300,000 a year, or they're on television getting paid, or they're writing books, or they're getting paid $250,000 to make a speech.
I guess you're trying to tell me what I shouldn't do after I leave, isn't it?
Well, I already figure that you're going to be on TV as a political, and that would make sense. God, I hope you do that, because
no,
we need
I'm
your
not,
voice
I'm
out there.
I'm not planning on that.
Let me make your voice out there.
The way you solve that is put an earnings test on it, just like we should anybody else.
Okay.
You know, put an earnings test on it.
Okay, that I would
agree
with.
If you're worth, if people in the Senate worth $100 million, why should they need a
pension?
Right here, Dr. Coburn.
We have one young lady in the middle I want you to get to over here, too.
What do you think of the penny plan?
Eliminating it? Or the penny plan of cutting it 1%?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing that can't be cut 1%. I agree with it. The problem is you're not going to get there because you take away control from the appropriators in Congress, and they're the author and perfecter of how the government should spend money. But that's a symptom of the problem. Do we have $17 trillion worth of debt? Yes. Is the fiscal balance sheet net debt and obligations of the federal government $122 trillion under generally accepted accounting principles? Yes. Until you send people to Washington that bothers, it's not going to be addressed. And that should bother us all because, as I answered this gentleman, the way governments in the past throughout the history have handled that is inflate your currency. It's the most unfair tax in the world because if, in fact, you're on the lower rung, you really lose much more than somebody in middle income or upper income. But that's what the plan is right now. We've got a $4 trillion Fed balance sheet and no idea how we deleverage that balance sheet without creating inflation. And you're going to see inflation rise in this country. All right. Here we go. Yes, ma'am. You were waving that hand so strong. You should have been a cheerleader.
Well, I never miss your town hall meetings, and I will miss them. And one of the things that I will miss is that when there's an incorrect premise stated, you always correct the incorrect premise. But you kind of slid over it tonight. So I want to challenge when you kept saying lack of leadership, and the gentleman over there said that he would willingly allow his Social Security to get cut. My contention is we get the government we've asked for and that we ask for this money. We ask for it. We don't turn it down. We always say the president spends too much money and there should be offsets. But when that tornado hit Moore, nobody advocated an offset.
Not you.
I mean the people. I say we have the government that we ask for, I mean the citizens. And you're saying lack of leadership, and I'm saying our representatives are giving us what we're asking for. We ask for this money. We cannot open the paper, Senator. We can't go a week that somebody isn't bragging about a grant they got.
Yeah, yeah.
So I challenge that it's not leadership, that we are the spoiled brats who want the stuff. And until we say we'll take less like that gentleman does, I don't think it's a leadership issue. I think they're giving us what we're asking for.
Well, that's a great point. I actually believe leadership can change things. I believe you can stand for a visionary, moral, character-based lead and talk about real issues and say, sacrifice is what we're going to have to do if we're going to get out of this. And I think a good leader can build a consensus around that. Because what happens if you don't do that? What happens if you don't? We just slide. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And economic opportunity. I mean, look at this where we are in recovery. The fact that we have $17 trillion worth of debt, $122 billion of unfunded liabilities, trillion. It's easy to mix trillion and billions and millions, isn't it? How is it that we're not addressing that right now? It is the ultimate thing that's going to bite us in the hind end. You know, we can have all the different... You know, I took a trip with Chuck Schumer to China. I flew commercially. They flew on a government jet. I said, I'm not doing that. And I met him over there. And the 3 days we were in China, what I discovered, and you all will discover this too, both the veteran gentleman here and the other gentleman who disagrees with me on everything except fiscal issues, is that 95% of the things in this country we actually agree on. We like the rule of law. We like opportunity. We want to get our kids educated. We want our kids to have opportunities. It's the 5% that we get hung up on that causes us to divide, that keeps us from doing other things that we ought to be doing. Leadership solves that problem. Leadership says, I don't have to have it my way, but we do have to address the problem. And we just haven't seen that. I was so mad at Barack Obama about 2.5 years ago. He gave a speech at Georgetown, and he said, Medicare's not in trouble. Well, nobody in the world other than him actually believes that. I don't think. If you look at what the trustees say on what's going to happen to Medicare Part A and Medicare Part D, you know, when the Republicans, and this is a real criticism of Republicans, I'm not against adding drugs as a senior benefit, but the Republicans passed that as a political ploy so prescription drug prices wouldn't be a part of the election that year. And the fact is if you add a benefit to Medicare, you have an obligation to figure out a funding stream to pay for it rather than charging it $13 trillion to our kids. There's no integrity in that. Yeah. So I take your point. You know, I understand the elixir is addictive. But real leadership can call people out to a higher calling, can call people to make a sacrifice when they weren't called to. Because you know what? We're all Americans. I don't care what your political party, your race, how many times you've been married, or what your children's last name is. We got to be together if we're going to get out of the troubles that are in front of us. And we need leadership that pulls us together that doesn't make political points by dividing us. Most of our problems, most people recognize Social Security is going to run out of money in 2032. Most people know Medicare Part A is going to be out of money in 2030. Most people will admit that Social Security disability will be out of money next year. So if that's the problem, why don't we all get together and say, how do we fix the problem and not think about us, but think about the generation that follows us? How do we fix it in a way with us sacrificing? I mean, my dad sacrificed. He was on the road 9-10 months a year when he was starting his business when I loved the boy. I hardly ever saw him. But he built a business out of that. He sacrificed to give me opportunity. How do we sacrifice to give the next generation opportunity? Who's asking that question? That's a question that's got to be asked. A real leader would be asking that question. We can do better. We're all in this boat. What we got to do is quit rowing in different directions. And leadership changes that. All right, next question. Sorry for the lecture.
Doctor, talk to us for a minute about the CDC and the Ebola virus and what we know about it, and should we be concerned about it?
I'm not concerned at all. This Ebola virus, under our healthcare system where we have infection control and good technique and good processes, I'm not worried. I would actually not have any trouble treating an Ebola patient. This Ebola virus, under primitive conditions, has a 60% case fatality rate. That means 60% of the people who get it die. It's not as virulent as cases we've seen in the past. And with great care, in our country, you'd probably see a 5-7%. All right? But I'm not worried about a mass epidemic in our country from it, because I think we have the techniques and public health officials. All those people you never see that are working behind the scenes will be called into action if we were to see that. We have, you know, I think we have a much greater risk to our health from trying to legalize marijuana than we ever would from Ebola. I also would say at the same time, I don't believe you incarcerate pot smokers. I think you use drug courts. They're fantastic. Drug courts, and Oklahoma's been pretty good at it, 67% of the people who go through a drug court never get back to drugs. Now, if you want to make an impact on somebody's life that's hooked on meth or hooked on something else, and they started with pot, they all started with pot, is send them to drug courts and don't incarcerate them. And I think if we were to do that, we'd make... I believe in drug treatment. It works. And I don't think it's a disease that you got hooked on meth. I think it's poor judgment. And then you got a physiologic addiction. But I don't think you're sick. I think you're an addict. And we can change that.
Senator, thank you for your service. I appreciate that and this opportunity to learn from you tonight. My question is regarding the president's executive orders. So many of them are in place. Do they end at his term, or what has to happen for those to go away?
They can be changed by the next president, so it depends on who the next president is. He has done a lot, but you know, so have Republican presidents. So, you know, the president and I obviously have a different philosophy. I respect him as a man. I don't agree with a lot of his executive orders. Some have stretched the limits. But the fact is most of them can be reversed. That's what he did. He reversed a ton of Bushes as soon as the first day he was in office. You know, they do and reversed them. So they don't have lasting effect. But they create expectations, which is what we saw on the border, that have negative effects for us. Where are we?
Right here, sir.
Okay.
Senator, I also thank you for your service to us in Washington. Just as a side personal note, the person that Wes Bledsoe mentioned that died last week was my brother, and I was his advocate, but there were some unfortunate things that happened to him in that nursing facility. But the reason I also want to mention that I'm an advocate for my son, who is 32 years old. He has autism. He has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Many people aren't aware of that. It's the worst form of epilepsy. He has grand mal seizures, drop and fall seizures, every type you can imagine. In 2010, my son was having seizures. He becomes aggressive when he's having seizures, and it's documented for years in his medical records. We took him by ambulance to a hospital here in Oklahoma City, and he has been turned away many times from hospitals because he becomes aggressive. We needed help with him that day, and it was in April of 2010. Some of you may have seen the story Channel 4 was gracious enough to cover about my son. While he was at the hospital, I wanted him admitted to get medication adjustments to help the seizures. He kicked a security guard, and he was charged with a felony assault and taken to the county jail on an $8,000 bond and held for 9 days. When he came out of jail, I had to get an attorney to get me in to see my son. He had a tooth broken off the gum line. He had bloody wrists. He was staggering. He was still having seizures. And I'm just asking you the question as to who enforces the Americans with Disability Act, because when that story came out about my son, a man in Maine picked it up, put it on an iPetition. I received over 800 signatures on that petition with parents telling me similar stories of their child with autism being turned away from hospital treatment or medical treatment because of their behaviors. And I would like to know who is responsible for enforcing this. My son, before he went to jail, the top picture is how he looked. He attended a sheltered workshop. He could walk. He's now in a wheelchair. So it's full-time caregiving for him at this point.
The Department of Justice would be who would enforce that. What you see is poor judgment. Not by your son. You know, he obviously has his limitations, and that's not understood. But the fact, you know, I don't know the details, but as a physician, I would have interceded and said, hey, let's get him controlled.
I did have a doctor intercede to try that. He said, I've gone to the top of this hospital to try to get help to your son to get on the same line. Yeah. They won't let it happen because he has autism. Every time they would say, because he has autism. I said, I'm not asking you to treat the autism. It's his seizures.
Yeah. Sad. It'd be the DOJ, U.S. Attorney.
That petition went to a bond after it was signed. And I heard nothing back.
Well, I can't give you answers for the administration. All right.
Hello, Senator.
Hello.
Thank you for your services for Oklahoma. My name is Leanna Osborne Sampson.
I am a council person who sits on Seminole Nation's council. I'm a representative of that nation. My question for you is about the Freedmen. We are not able to receive any services from Indian Health Services, but they do count us in the government funding. How is that?
As you know where I am on the Freedmen issue, I fully back the rights of the Freedmen in all the tribes to be full members of the tribes. I don't know how that happens. The fact is if you're counted but you get no benefits and you're not recognized as a member of the tribe, they should, to me, that they should not be receiving funding for you. But you can talk to Brian Treat on my office in Washington. We've been involved in that. I think the discrimination by the tribes against their former slaves that they granted membership to and now are changing that is hard to defend.
Senator, if I spied on you and your committee staff, if I hacked into your computer, if I lied under oath in a hearing, wouldn't you feel compelled to have me charged with a crime or crimes? And since the head of the CIA, John Brennan, and the head of the NSA, John Clapper, admitted to these crimes, why have they not been charged?
Well, there are a lot of assumptions in your statement that aren't in fact true. The one thing that is factually correct is General Clapper did answer a question erroneously. What you don't know is the senator who asked that question violated the ethics rule, in my opinion, of the Senate by asking it, because he knew it would cause him to expose data that was top secret. That's number one. I sat on the Intelligence Committee, and I can tell you the vast majority of what you've heard in the media is erroneous as to your emails being tapped or your phones being tapped. And let me take a minute to explain that, because it's not good enough for me just to say it. The 215 program was set up after 9/11. Nobody's phones, and these are no phone conversations, by the way. These are just numbers. There's no phone conversation. Never gets looked at unless there's a nexus to a known terrorist outside of this country. Never gets looked at. There are 12 people that work for the federal government that get to access that. They never get to access that unless a federal judge says they can. We're about to become so distrustful of the federal government through all the erroneous crap, and I use that word, that Edward Snowden has put out, that we're about to lose our capability to defend ourselves. And there's a big movement that we're so afraid of Big Brother that we would rather not have anything and have another attack. And let me tell you something. We will have another terrorist attack. It will happen. And the 215 program has been responsible for stopping several, because we connect with who the terrorist is talking to and who that person is talking to. We don't know what they're saying. As soon as that connection is made, it's given to the FBI. It stops after that as far as the federal government, other than the FBI. The FBI, if they want to tap that phone or look at those emails, have to go before a federal judge and get permission on a show cause. Why should you be able to violate this right of a citizen of the United States? And the probable cause has to be there or a judge doesn't give it to them. These aren't Republican judges. These are judges. They don't look at whether you're an R or D. And so we've had all this talk about how terrible the NSA is. The NSA has kept us free. And there's some things, I would rather we never have to have an NSA. That isn't the world we live in. And so what you've heard is not accurate. And let me tell you what kind of oversight we do. My staff's out at the CIA and the NSA at least once or twice a month with two or three other staff members with assigned things to check to see what are they doing. It's not carte blanche. There are checks and balances. That's how we maintain our freedom. But that voice, I can't tell you everything I know about that, because then I'd break the ethics rules. I wish I could tell you all. But on this one, I've seen it. I sleep better at night knowing we got an NSA and a CIA. And have they made some mistakes? Yes. Have they been intentional? Most of the time, no. Have your rights been 99.9999% protected? Yes. And when they haven't been, there's been a dadgum good cause, because somebody's trying to hurt us. So you can give, we can say they're all bad guys. I want to tell you what I've seen internationally as I've traveled. I've seen CIA members who you'll never know, who've given their lives for this country, never will get credit for it, never will get a gold star, never will get a Purple Heart, give up their families, give up their whole way of life, and embed somewhere in this country to protect us. They're my heroes. They give it all. They're just as important as our military. And they never get the recognition. What they get is the criticism. And what they do is tremendously valuable to you every day.
One final question, Dr. Coburn.
Hello, sir. Straight in front of you.
Okay, gotcha.
My name is Tiana. I do not always agree with you, but as...
Neither does my wife. She's a...
But as a citizen, I am
most... I got a mother-in-law that's never voted for me.
But... No, no. But again, as a citizen, I am very grateful to have you helping us, because, frankly, you are a wonderful human being. My question is hemp. It is not marijuana.
I'm all for it.
Yeah. Oh,
I think we ought to use it. It's a great production device. It's a great agricultural right. Will some people abuse it? Yes, but the vast majority of the time, that's something we can compete globally on.
The pollen from hemp will get into the air and will infect marijuana crops and actually decrease their toxicity. I think if we want to fight marijuana, we need to plant hemp everywhere.
Well, maybe not everywhere. We don't have a... Let me just interrupt. We don't have a farm program yet for it, so I'm sure as soon as we get one, we'll plant it everywhere.
I'm just saying, hemp and stinging nettle and several other quote-unquote weeds have been processed in very wonderful ways into amazing fabric, fibers, and other very useful, absolutely... non-offensive products, and in fact, at one point, the U.S. government paid American farmers to grow hemp for the war effort, my family included. And many.
You sound like you're from Minnesota.
South Dakota.
South Dakota. Close. It's close.
So, yes, as a alternative fabric supporter... I would be grateful if you would continue to voice that alternative fabrics should be encouraged in Oklahoma, and that I feel that it would be good for our economy, our environment, the lack of pesticides, and the ability to grow in practically any soil with negligible amounts of water.
You got your commercial made. All right, we're out of time. We're at 7:30. First of all, thank you for being here.
I just wanted to answer about those tapes.
It makes you feel good when people are interested in what's happening. It gives you a good feeling that you're not just working for a few people, you're working for a whole lot. We don't always have town hall meetings at a time that's convenient for everybody, but the fact that you showed up means you want to be part of the solution. Most of them. Maybe one guy over here doesn't want to be. I'm just picking on you. You're a veteran. You can take it. It really has been my privilege to represent the state of Oklahoma. It's a great state with great people all across it. I've been everywhere in this state. There's probably not any place I haven't been in the last 10, 12 years. All my kids live in Oklahoma now. I worked hard to get them back here. And, well, there's a reason for it. I want my grandchildren raised as Oklahomans.
Yes.
It'll do them good in the future that we're getting ready to see. So thank you again for being here. Thank you again for Dr. Seacrest for allowing us to be here. We appreciate it so much. God bless you all and good night.